So, I've said a few little things about injustice, Buddhist style, and how we deal with problems in life. Hopefully, I haven't told you what you already know. Hopefully, I've been controversial. That's why we discuss things. If we discuss things which we already agree on, there's no point to learning. So now, I'm going to open it up to what I call the three C's. Questions, comments and complaints. Well, it's not really questions as a cue, but sounds like it. So, what I've said so far, what don't you agree with? Yeah, go on.
Rehabilitation. And you talked about looking forward and not looking back. And but what you did say was that there was a greater value in looking forward. But you didn't say that there was no value in looking back. And I think that for real rehabilitation, there has to be an examination of the past, in not with exclusively looking back on what happened, but Truth and Reconciliation commissions not looking for necessarily to punish people, but for them to accept responsibility for their acts.
Good.
So at that level, it does seem to be some value in looking back. If you compare that to what happened or is happening in Spain, talk of what happened during Franco's regime, and it was never really discussed. There's no idea of Truth and Reconciliation, and only now, all these years later, there are. It seems to be coming back. The problem seems to have resurged because there was no examination in any great deal about what happened. So, whilst you emphasised that it was always very important to look forward, I would also add that it was also,
yeah.
As it's not either or. It can be both. That was all.
Yes, I agree with you, but I would add, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission only works when there's an amnesty. Punishment is what drives the truth underground. No one would admit what they've done if they're going to be executed or put in jail for so many years. So if we want to find the truth, we have to have amnesties. And that goes, I said this afternoon, with husbands and wives. Why do you lie to each other? Why do your children lie to your parents? It's because Daddy would kill me if he found out. Many kids have told me that. There was one little girl, she was 16, and she became pregnant. And she told me, and I asked her, have you told your mum and dad yet? She said, no, they'll kill me. That's what I come to you for. Can you please tell them for me? Now, isn't it more important that your children trust you, so that they can call on you to help when they're really in big trouble? Isn't it important that your husband can actually tell you everything he's been up to, so he can share with you and solve the problems? Isn't it important that people can admit what they've done? It is important. Punishment is what drives the truth underground. So yes, we could have Truth and Reconciliation, but please have that amnesty so strong. We say we're going to forgive. Only then can the truth come out. But after a while, the truth gets bent the longer it lives in the past. Because if you ask any psychologist, I'll just tell you a great little experiment which was done. A psychologist, he was in Canada, but he did his degree in the United States. He was about to retire, cleaning out some old papers. It was a very famous study. And he got some old papers when he started off as a psychologist, where he interviewed a school, and all the kids were asked a series of questions, very clear black and white questions. You know, did your parents use corporal punishment on you if you made a mistake, or did they use other means of you know, did your parents take you out on the weekend, or did they just leave you alone, whatever. And he had all these answers from the past, about 30 years previously. he thought he would try and find out as many of those young students who are now adults as he could and ask them the same questions and see if their answers were consistent. And even simple things like, did your parents beat you or did they not use corporal punishment? So many people who said, yes, they did, now remember that they didn't. So many people who said they didn't now remember that they did. Ask any psychologist. We create the past. We bend it. You ask, you know, some of the people you grew up with, you know, your brothers, your siblings. Did mummy say this? Did we go this place for holiday that year? You'll have arguments. Simply because the way we create the past is like that old game I used to play at school, Chinese Whispers. You know the game of Chinese Whispers? This, to when you stand in a line and your teacher says one thing to the first person, they say it to the next, you 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 say it to the next. When it gets to the end, it's very different than what it started. You know, you are an English man, you will understand this. In the First World War, this actually happened. The general told the major, send reinforcements, we're going to advance. The major told the captain, the lieutenant, the sergeant, and the corporal. The corporal told the privates, and it got down the order, send reinforcements, we're going to advance, became send 3 and 4 pence, which was British money, 3 shillings and 4 pennies. Send 3 and 4 pence, we're going to a dance. That actually happened. Every time it's repeated, it gets changed slightly. And that is the way memory works. We don't remember what happened last year. We remember the last time we remembered it. It's Chinese Whispers. So it changes every time you remember it. Only slightly. But enough that what we thought happened in the past didn't happen. It was different. That is why when it gets so far in the past, such as, you know, the Spanish Civil War, basically you ask any psychologist, no one can know what really happened. Our memories are not that good that we really know who did what to who. They've been changed by time. You ask any traffic policeman, they take witness accounts of what happened in a traffic accident. And some people say it was a white car, and the police know it was a black car. It's amazing, just that what we remember is often not what happened. So just in your life, don't keep thinking, yeah, you know, it was your turn, you did this. You don't know what happened in the past, so don't argue with your husband or your wife. Most of the past is created. Obviously, there's some things which we know really happened. There's evidence. But just memories is not good enough evidence. You go on.
Probably a bit of a divergence, really. But I recently read An Examined Life, which was a casebook of psychoanalysis. And it seemed to be that a lot of people were there at 60 or 70 years of age, and they were trying to remember very, very small events that happened to them when they were 5. And it seemed to be after several years of being in psychoanalysis that they discovered that these events had an enormous significance for them. Mm. And it struck me that how on earth could they remember what happened to them at 5 with any certainty whatsoever? And yet the psychoanalysis would say, well, this is why, this explains your present situation. And I thought, such a small event, and an attitude of a teacher or a parent, and it seemed to be incredible, because there seemed to be no certainty that you could even remember that event.
Indeed, you don't remember the event, but you remember the last time you remembered the event. And this is what happens. Say you were abused by someone you respected or loved, like your parent, you lose your trust, or your trust gets dented. And because you doubt other people, what you see in others is what you get. And you know, you interpret other events when you are let down as more people distrusting you. a little seed becomes a huge tree. So I can actually see how that happens with a cause and event sequence, of same as how a seed makes a tree. The tree can't remember the seed, but a tree grows from that seed. For those of you who know Buddhism, that's what karma is, how it does affect you. It's only a seed, you can't remember what happened. But that sort of changes the direction of your life, and you start to see things and interpret things in other ways. But anyway, that's a divergence there, but it's interesting. Okay, so come on, some more questions. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much for the very inspirational talk. I learned a lot. I have a question. It's very vague. I don't know if I can articulate, but I'll try anyway. I'm from Japan, so you could imagine I'm a very confused person because we're very, very influenced by the Western world. Though we also are really, we are in Asia, and then part of our society is very, very Buddhist, I may say. But then why I'm confused is because I'm also trying to learn Buddhism, and I have impressions of, from reading and also from your talk today, that Buddhist has an emphasis on forgiveness, letting things go. I have this slight impression, though, that Buddhist seems very good at letting things go, but what about problem solving? If you look back, let's say, some traditional Buddhist countries, there are also very a large number of persistent social problems. But by sort of focusing on letting go attitude, can we really solve problems? You said that, well, let's wait for the time, but isn't it a little bit passive? Or, you know, so I really, well, I appreciate if you could elaborate on the problem-solving part of the Buddhism.
Yes, thank you. Very good. I did mention that, you know, that we acknowledge the mistakes, we forgive, but then we take action, we make sure it doesn't happen again. So it's that third part. It's not just forgiveness, it's the truth, the forgiveness, and then seeing if there's something we can do to stop the problem. Simple thing. I was mentioning this a little bit earlier. One of the reasons why we have trouble with religions is because religion isolates people. In the Guardian newspaper, straight after 9/11, there was a great article, "Please, it's about time to ban religious schools." Because religious schools isolate people from very young. And you can go to a Catholic primary school, a Catholic high school, a Catholic university, marry a nice Catholic boy, and spend all your life with other Catholics, never knowing anyone else. And that isolates people from a very, very young age. In Islam, you can go to a madrasa and just only associate with other people of the same part of Islam as you. And of course, that is an obvious breeding ground for distrust of the other. And okay, this is social engineering, but I think our world needs this. It's one reason in Australia that I have blocked any Buddhist school being done in Australia. Use my influence, because I think that is wrong. It's against human rights. Article 18, to make a kid a Buddhist or a Christian or a Muslim at such a young age. Article 18 guarantees the right to choose your own religion or no religion. And you're brainwashing a kid at that age. And I don't care, even with the best will in the world, if it's a Buddhist school, you're going to emphasize the superiority of Buddhism against all other religions. It's obvious. So, it's a very radical thing to do, to dismember all the Catholic schools, the Anglican schools, the Jewish schools. If you want to learn your culture, learn world culture first, religion on Saturdays or Sundays or Fridays if you're a Muslim. But please don't begin to the schools. Schools is where we learn world culture. Now the knowledge and learning of our world, the sciences, the arts. Religion is sometimes what separates us. Culture, arts, science actually unites us. So if we could have that social engineering by banning all religious schools, straight away You know, you play soccer, you play tennis, you know, with a Muslim, with a Thai Christian, and you're a Japanese Buddhist. They're your friends. And you find you won't be able to have a war with your friends. You'll understand each other. That was from The Guardian, just, what was it, after 9/11, almost 12 years ago. A brilliant article, and I agree with it totally. There's some practical thing we can do, actually, to stop injustices, as far as the rights of women are concerned. I wasn't passive. I ordained bhikkhunis and took flak for that. Ali Hurst Ali, if you know this amazing woman who was a Muslim, who became a member of the Dutch Parliament, who wrote a great book. Basically, her thesis, her solution to stop Islamic terrorism was to give more power to women in Islam. She's saying, give more power to women in Islam. You're not destroying Islam. You're not going against their culture. Promoting women, and you'll get a far softer version of Islam. When it's run by men, men can be very aggressive, and they can cause a huge number of problems. This is a generalization, but it was a solution proposed by an ex-Muslim, Ali Hurst Ali, who knew the problem much better than I would ever know it. And her solution makes a lot of sense to me. Stop invading Iraq and Afghanistan or whatever, but promote the rights and the freedoms and the power of women in the Islamic world. These are solutions which you don't just be passive and just say, oh, just forget about it. No, you actually do something about it. Politics. The Buddhist solution to politics in our world is remembering why a person standing for election was called a candidate. That comes from the Latin word candid, meaning white. Because in the Roman Senate, anyone standing for election had to wear white. That was signifying they were going to stand for election, and that white was a symbol of their purity. They were elected on their past conduct, not on their future promises. That's why it became a great power. If you are going to elect a Secretary General of the UN, if you're going to elect someone to run your business, you don't elect them on what they promise to do in the future. You elect them on their conduct and their proven ability from the past. So, in politics, for goodness sake, stop voting in the people who promise the most. Vote in the people who have shown from their past conduct they are good administrators, they are honest. Forget about what they promise, because they will break those promises, as all politicians do. That goes back to the Roman Senate, people being elected on their past conduct, not on their future promises. Why can't we do that? Another problem, which I was talking about at the very earliest, we need to regulate religion. When people shout out, freedom of religion, freedom of religion, then no one even challenges them, because we think that's a basic human right, where it is not a basic human right. The French government in 2001 passed a law, the only country I know of, you know, in the developed world, which passed a law limiting religious freedom, saying wherever a religious tradition or cultural act clearly is against basic human rights and freedoms, then it's illegal in France. It was stating that human rights and freedoms are more important than all cultural rights of religion. There's a brilliant little statement there. Religion, like anything else, needs to be regulated. Whenever we have anything self-regulated, like FIFA, you know, which is the soccer organization, whether it's the police, whether it's some business, self-regulation never ever works. You do need regulation outside. The press does need some regulation. We accept that. So does religion. Religion will never be able to regulate itself. So, as a leader of religion, I'm very against religious freedom. Limit it, for goodness sake. Human rights, the law of the land, have to take precedence. So those are some of the things which I'm propounding. I've got no legislative power, but I do have some influence. Yeah, you want to say something? Yeah.
I could say something, but are you suggesting that religions are forced to, for example, ordain women bishops and do various other things? If they want to operate in a country, then they should be forced, or that they should ordain practicing homosexuals.
Yeah, I think
they should be forced to do it they want to operate.
They should have some pressure on them, for example, to say that, well, if they want to get all of the benefits of religion, such as the many tax reliefs, then they have to follow sort of human rights. In other words, that yes, basically, force is not the word I would use, but strongly encouraged. And I think that's quite important to say that if there is no freedom for people to follow that religion in their own way, then there's some human rights being abused there. Okay, that's interesting. Anyway, yes, it's a great question. I'm not quite sure if I've answered it well yet, because it's one of those curly questions which I love, which I think about and just get a better answer as soon as I left the hall. But it's hard to force them, but it's wrong to let them get away with saying no to, like, a person, a really good spiritual woman who wants to be a bishop. Why not? If that's their faith, they're a Catholic. And they believe in Catholicism. They spent all their life as a Catholic. And they love that religion. And they serve that religion. Now, to them, it's a terrible imposition that they cannot serve at that level. So looking at the churches, so, oh, they may have this dogma here, dogma there, but looking at them, so they are being abused. Great question, but I don't know. But I'd certainly put more pressure on them to have more gay popes. You know, may have one now. I don't know. Yes.
In the action of mindfulness, in the Buddhist sense of sati,
yeah.
I don't know if I'm wrong, but I learned that there is also one component of recollection, not yeah. only being in the present moment. This recollection can also involve looking at the shit from the past? Or?
Yeah. This is basically, it is some of your learning of the past. It's almost like the tradition which one grows up with. But again, the learning from the past, the recollection of the past, not so much as memory, too much of the past. It is basically your tradition, your learning, your education. That's all part of that, the word sati or smriti in Sanskrit. But the main part of mindfulness is being aware of what's happening right now. Too much time spent in the past blocks you from experiencing what is happening right now. Too much worry about the future is neglecting the place the future is made, which is right now. This is the only time we can do anything for the future. So we just have a more imminent idea in Buddhist meditation practice. Working now, acting now, rather than putting off until the future. I don't know if that's the question you're really making, but as far as the past is concerned, we spend too much time in the past. And one of the other things, again, with dogmas is all about what you learned in the past. And too often you will find in your life that the past knowledge is always challenged. And there's very recently, I don't know if there's any physicists here, any scientists, but there was a great video on TEDx channel, the channel for new ideas, by the Cambridge physicist Rupert Sheldrake. And he was saying that science should be split up into scientific method, which, you know, we should all value and follow, and scientific dogma, which we'd all always challenge. One of the problems of modern science is that there's too much dogma. And he mentioned one particular incident which resonated with me, because I heard this from Professor Fred Hoyle, who's the Lucasian Professor of Physics, a chair which Stephen Hawking now has, about 40 years ago. For those of you who know Newton's law of gravity, you know, the attraction of two massive bodies is equal to the product of their masses divided by the square of their distance apart, multiplied by the universal gravitational constant, big G. And Fred Hoyle said 40 years ago, why does big G have to be a constant? And this guy, Rupert Sheldrake, he did some research. There are many organizations in Europe which keep measuring these constants, and they are not constant, they do change. And because he said that, he was banned from TEDx. His video was taken off, and because the two scientific advisors said this is too controversial. And he came back and said, see, I was right. It is dogmatic. That's why they're trying to shut me up. And then he got back on TEDx again. We must always question. There is no such thing as a dogma which cannot be questioned. And certainly in Buddhism, there's no such dogma in Buddhism which no one can question. And if the evidence proves it's wrong, throw it out. Never let your faith bend the facts. Let the facts bend the faith. That's the opposite of dogma. And you can probably see in all organizations, there's always dogma, which stop you seeing the present truth. Never let your learning stand in the way of truth. Too much stuff. We think, oh, this is what happens. This is how it should be. But the evidence is right in front of you. And too often, we prefer the learning, what the book said, or the experts say, rather than what you can see for yourself. Scientific dogma, throw away. Scientific method, always challenging, always questioning, finding the evidence, following the evidence, rather than what you're told. That's really important. I'm sure there's much dogma in the UN. Please challenge it. If it doesn't work, if it's not right, challenge it. That's the only way forward. Yeah, go on.
Hi. In Thailand, in the last few weeks or something, I mean, Buddhist monks have been on the front page quite a bit. You know, it's interesting you raising the example of, a new monk, you know, breaking the rules and so on. And obviously in Thailand we tend to have a cycle of every so many years there's some monks that become famous because of what they're doing that seem to break the rules. I just wonder what you think the reaction of the Buddhist communities, I mean, should be, or there's a lot of discussion going on at the moment.
The reaction to the Buddhist community should be learning. But how can a person have a helicopter unless someone offers it to them? About a year ago, I found out that somebody offered me a bottle of Johnnie Walker whiskey. Now, this is actually how it happened, okay? There was a big bucket of offerings. So on the top was soap and toothpaste. I didn't realize when I received that bucket of goods for the monastery that on the bottom was a small bottle of Johnnie Walker whiskey. And it was only when I sent it down to the kitchen and the people working in the kitchen came up and say, Ajahn Brahm, you've just received a bottle of whiskey. I didn't know it. But why do Thai people offer that? It's because they have the very stupid, wrong, incorrect idea that what you offer to a monk is what you will have when you go to heaven. Okay, this is the thinking. Okay, so I want to drink whiskey in heaven. I've got to offer it to a monk. I'll put it in the bottom so they don't see. I want to drive a Ferrari in heaven. Therefore, you have to offer it to the monastery. That is not how Buddhism works, for goodness sake. There was a time, there was a five, six, 7 years ago, a general in the army had a dream. He'd made offerings for his father by giving alms food to monks, but his father came in a dream saying, "He's very thirsty, he's very thirsty. You didn't offer any water to the monks." And from that time onwards, you go on alms round in the street of Bangkok and you have 10 or 20 bottles of water. He had no place in the bowl for food. And it's just simply because people had the dumb idea, if you want to have water in heaven, you've got to offer water to monks. That is not how karma works. If you have good intentions, it doesn't matter what you offer. Offer something which is appropriate for monks. Not whiskey, not cars, not money. Don't offer money to a monk. It's against the rules. Nisakya Pajitya 18. Offer money to the monastery, to the temple, not to monks. It's against the rules. Nisakya Pajitya 18. So once, it'd be great if there was more education of the lay Buddhists in Thailand of what the Buddha said you should offer to a monk and what you shouldn't. Then you will protect your religion. When monks get rich, they'll get up to all sorts of mischief. And they've got no money, what can they do? So please, you look after the monastic sangha of monks and nuns as well. Number two, people think it's bad karma to criticize a monk. You see them watching movies, or especially this guy, Lumpu Nen, whatever it was, watching pornographic movies in a garage in Ubon. Criticize them for goodness sake. Let people know. Be a whistleblower. Too many people think, no. If I criticize the monk, that's very bad karma for me. You will find if you read the original teachings of the Buddha, all the rules came because you kept the monks honest. You saw them doing bad things and you told the Buddha, and the Buddha said, "Monks, don't do this." The whole of Buddhism became pure because the lay Buddhists saw monks or nuns doing wrong things or doing dangerous things. And you told the Buddha, and the Buddha said, "Yes, you're right," and made a rule because of it. From the very beginning, the monastic sangha, the monks and nuns have depended on you to keep us honest. As I say, we cannot self-regulate. You have to help regulate for us. So please, keep criticizing. Please point out the faults. If you don't, the sangha gets worse and worse and worse. Yeah.
I would like to ask a question. We want to forgive, to show compassion, but sometimes we get very angry and we are not going to speak kindness. We are going to react aggressively to the other person in front of us. How do we get rid of anger from our mind?
Now you know where we have problems in the world, where they come from. So how you do that is you have to learn how to look at the other side of that person. One very simple way, get a piece of paper out, line down the middle, put the person's name on top. On the left-hand side, write down all the reasons why that person is rotten, they're a bastard, they're terrible, they're a ma, whatever it is you want to call them. Write it down there, all the reasons why you're getting angry at them. On the right-hand side, fill the same amount of space with all of their admirable good qualities. Why they're a good person, a kind person, all the good deeds they've done. When you're angry, that's very difficult to do. But force yourself to do that. And then cut the paper down the middle. The left-hand side, all the reasons to be angry at them, throw that in the trash can. The right-hand side, all the reasons you respect them and admire them, keep that and keep reading it. You can't get angry then.
Even though the list on the left-hand side is longer.
No, you only have a certain sheet of paper. They have to be the same. It's hard to fill the right-hand side. But that's actually part of the therapy. You force yourself to see the good in another person. And then you find you can't get angry at them. Has anyone ever got angry at you? Are you a bad person? Of course you are, but they still get angry at you. So you think that I get angry at somebody else, it's because they're a bad person. It's only because you can only see the bad in them. That's why you get angry. If you force yourself to see the other side of them, the good in them, anger disappears. Okay, last question. I have to go because I've been told if I don't leave by 4:30, I'm going to get stuck in the traffic and I'm not be able to get to my destination. Yes, last question.
Thank you very much. You mentioned that when there's nothing to do, do nothing, and that can lead to solve problems. The question is, in life, when you face many situations, some simple, some complicated, how do you understand when is the time to do nothing?
Because that is the most important question. And you say, is there a solution? And you look at that solution. Now, can it be actually implemented? Is it possible? And if you think, not now, it's not possible right now, then put it on the back burner. Leave it there for a time when you can implement that. The problem with most people is we don't know how to do nothing. I have an article which is I keep in my monastery. A few years ago, the doctors in a couple of hospitals in Jerusalem went on strike. For 3 weeks, the doctors did not perform any surgery except emergency stuff. And they showed that in those 3 weeks, the death rate plummeted when the doctors weren't operating. That's true. You can ask people, why is that happening? The doctors aren't doing anything and people get healthier. Interesting, isn't it? So sometimes the best thing to do is leave things alone. If you've got a wound on your... Sometimes the best thing, clean it up, isolate it. It heals by itself. Too often I've seen in my life people with the best intentions getting involved and making things far worse. Sometimes we should learn how to let things be. And I think a lot of times, you know, we'll be a better place. Not always. This is not generalization. But sometimes we get involved when really there's not a really clear solution. We make it worse. Be careful. Okay, you want to say something? I think I can easily read your face. Okay. Well, thanks again for listening. I hope it was useful. If it wasn't, never mind. So thanks again, and a nice way of spending an hour with you. So I wish you all the best. And my Anu Mota for all your hard work. Working in the UN is one of the best livelihoods you could ever do. That's one of the Eightfold Paths. Serving for make a better world. If you don't do it, who would? So please work hard. Don't worry about your pay. Worry about the job you're doing for the world. Thank you.